Well, it's really...
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Thursday, May 21st, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government and opening a public hearing on House Bill 5041, the Charter of the State. Mr. Borden, anything before we get started again?
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members of the Subcommittee. The meeting materials are on May 18th, 2015, and as this is a continuation of their original Phase 2 presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Treasurer and Mr. Bond, thank you again for your flexibility and willingness to come back for yet another day. And I apologize for being late. I had a minor emergency.
Understood. Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, thank you for having us back. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the State Treasurer. With me is Darren Bond, the Deputy State Treasurer. The good news about reconvening is today we also have John Shervam here. He is the Chief Investment Officer for the State of Oregon, and some of you may have questions that he would be in the best position to answer as well. As you will recall, we left off on slide number 16, POP 101, Investment Solutions. Governor's recommended budget for Investment Solutions was $6,011,273 of other funds. That was 19 positions, 17.48 FTE. Madam Chair, you look like you're...
No, I'm listening.
Oh, it's here.
I've had the more IT problems this session than you can shake a stick at, and I'm having them right now.
That's why I don't use IT. I shake sticks. The sticks are more reliable.
Yeah.
The modified request.
County matches.
There you go. The modified request adds five positions, includes the five e-board positions. So the modified request is $7,399,043. Again, other funds, that's 21.56 FTE. State statute requires the Oregon Investment Council, the OIC, to provide for an audit of the investment function every 4 years. The last review, which was recently concluded, had several findings in four key categories. The first takes a look at our governance model, our investment policies, the investment risk management, in other words, our ability to identify and manage risk in our portfolio, and our investment operations management. We're not going to load you up with too many complicated slides because, frankly, sometimes it obfuscates important material. So I just want to draw your attention to the most important aspect of this slide on page 17. If you look for the red column in the middle, it says Oregon State Treasury, OST. It reflects the fact that the OIC has a total of $88 billion under management. If you go all the way to the bottom there, what you see is we have 28 FTE in our investment division. Mm-hmm. When you look at the orange column to the left of that, that orange column reflects our public sector peer group, meaning those public funds that have assets in the range between 30 and 100 billion. So again, we're towards the top of that asset class. The average for our peer group is 96 FTE in their investment operations. So we're about a third of our peer group in terms of FTE in the public sector, despite the fact we have one of the largest portfolios, and as some of you are aware, we also have one of the more complex portfolios.
Share with us really quick why that is. Why are we so limited?
Representative Chair Smith and members of the committee, I don't have a long enough historical tenure to be able to give you an answer other than a smart alecky one, which is we haven't staffed adequately, so maybe I'd defer to the deputy treasurer who's been around longer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, the members of the committee, Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer. Part of it is based on, I just think, bureaucratic inertia. The program started in, really in the 70s as a kind of as a modern portfolio, fundamentally different nature of the investment market at that time. As things have got much more complex, we haven't grown to address it. Additionally, if you...
And that's a fair answer right there.
And I would point out that we've been aware of the staffing issues probably for the last 10 years or so, but we just came through 10 years of budget cuts, and the reality of us getting positions during that time was absolutely zero. So, in fact, through that period of time, Treasury lost positions. So.
And that's a fair answer. I just wasn't sure if there is another reason for this. Senator?
I think you, Chair Smith. Your next slide adequately shows the growth of your portfolio against the growth of your staff, which is quite an alarming difference. Going on the particular slide, your last slide, I have to wonder a little bit if you're comparing apples and apples there, because on the one hand, you're almost 4-to-1 understaffed compared to the public sector, or almost 10-to-1 understaffed by the private sector.
Correct.
If that were the case, if you're really comparing apples and apples, the private sector and the public sector would be after your people and willing to pay them $500,000 a year to find out how to save that labor.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I would point out that recently our chief investment officer was hired away from another fund for about 3 times what we pay them. So I think you're right. I think that is exactly the case. But you also have to remember, there is a certain advantage. We live in Oregon, and people do like to live here. I agree. I would, when you look at these numbers, as the treasurer pointed out, 96 is the median number. There's only 3 funds that in this sample group, there are only 3 funds larger than Treasury was. So in terms of size of assets, so far and away, the bulk of the medium sized funds are funds that are significantly smaller than Treasury are, with still these kinds of numbers of staff.
So have you lost other people besides your CAO?
We lost our senior real estate investment officer. We lost a private equity investment officer to a firm in Chicago. One way that we've addressed this issue is that we have significantly outsourced. We have a very highly outsourced model. Mm-hmm. So virtually all of our peers manage significantly more assets in-house than we do. Okay. We manage them externally and pay them.
So there's a difference a little bit between apples and oranges. I'm not saying you're not understaffed, but okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
So slide 18, page 18, Senator Whitsitt's pointed out what I think is really the crux piece of information from this slide. Over time, the slide starts on the left-hand side in 1995. It goes through 2004. What you see is the portfolio has trended towards significant growth. It's grown threefold over the time period, but staffing levels have remained relatively constant. What's sort of interesting about this slide is if you go to the right-hand side and you look at the orange line, that's staffing levels, that relates to staffing levels of back office operations, so audits, fund accountants, analysts, that sort of thing. That orange line reflects what you would expect the portfolio size to be given the number of FTE we have in back office management. And so when you look at that orange line, what it's basically saying is the portfolio is over 4 times larger than you would expect given our back office resources that we have.
So I want to ask a question on that, Mr.
Please.
Treasurer. So is the number of transactions or the number of audit reviews or the number of significantly increasing as Oregon's portfolio value increases? To me, I'm trying to figure out, sometimes just because things go up in value doesn't necessarily mean we need more staff. Put $100 into my checking account and it's worth a dollar, or I gain $2 over the course of a year. It doesn't mean I need to hire someone as it incrementally increases.
Mr. Co-Chair, it's a great point. To a great extent, it's just where you put the decimal point from one perspective. But I would argue that's not the right perspective.
It helped us understand, because I'm really not trying to be argumentative. I really
what you're seeing is, as a portfolio, an institutional portfolio particularly grows like this, it necessarily grows in complexity if you're going to do it right. So we're going into new markets. We're taking advantage of new opportunities because that's where the money is. And the portfolio is becoming more complex just by nature of the assets that are available to us, that as prudent fiduciaries, we're trying to take advantage of the return that we can get on those. But furthermore, it's becoming a much more complex regulatory environment out there. So as we're investing all across the world, and as you're seeing now, the world is beginning to catch up to, you know, to the Western economies in terms of their regulatory regimes, there's a proliferation of law and regulation that has to be determined for all of these funds all across the country.
And again, that's logical to me.
That's logical. And that's across the country. And also think about how things have changed here over the last 15 years relative to our own regulatory reporting requirement. Mm-hmm. The disclosure that's required under FASB and GASB and things that has dramatically increased the workload on staff for addressing this.
To me, that's logical. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. And I think to some extent, Mr. Bond, you've already answered my question, but it's really a question for you and the Treasurer. If I look at this graph, which is very helpful, I see that really, it was basically in 2002, based on this graph, that things really started to diverge, right? There was clearly a difference even between starting in 1996. The blue line started to go up well above the orange or the yellow lines, right? But in 2002, it really took off. And I know you guys have been trying to address this in one way or another for the past several years. And I know I can't hold you responsible for your predecessor, certainly, Mr. Treasurer, but Mr. Bond, with your historical perspective, why is this issue really coming to the forefront now? Is it really the regulatory piece more? Or because it seems to me that if I think about what was happening in the market in 2002 and the number of instruments, if you will, that were available at that point, the dot-com explosion, the increase in real estate investment trusts, all that kind of stuff, the increase in private equity that the state got involved with, and clearly the success was reflected in this graph. What happened over the past couple of years that really made it clear that your staffing was inadequate compared to 15 years ago?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'll take my stab at this, and then I'll defer to the Deputy Treasurer as well, because we approach this from different perspectives. I came in the wake of the collapse of the stock market in 2008. From my own perspective, I noticed a couple of interesting things. The most interesting was that all of our investments seemed to move in lockstep. It seemed that diversification didn't help us the way that I would have expected it to. It seemed like all of our different investment classes were weirdly correlated in ways I didn't expect them to be weirdly correlated. And it seemed that the staff that I now had responsibility for was buried in responsibilities. And so I had started asking questions about not only our staffing levels, but also compensation was a big deal. You may recall when I came in as treasurer in 2010, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not we had the appropriate compensation, whether or not we had the right management processes in place. I had questions about the governance model, which hadn't changed in over 40 years, even though the portfolio struck me as being significantly different than it was 40 years earlier. So I called on outside auditors and consultants and industry experts to do a top-to-bottom review of our investment operations. Long story short, our investment operations have always delivered extremely good results on the whole for the pension system and for the other funds that they manage. So I think to some degree the outsourcing model worked. There was something of a badge of honor associated with being able to say that we were, you know, we were lean and we were mean and we were successful. But what, and I'll get into this in later slides, the auditors and the outside consultants and the industry experts were far less impressed. And what they instead identified was, number one, a gross incapacity around staffing. We were grossly understaffed compared to what they would expect related to best practices, and they also noted that we operate under a deeply flawed governance model. That governance model made it very difficult for us to take advantage of opportunities in the market. And as Deputy Treasurer Bond said, the market moves much more quickly. There's information flow. There's more competition. It's global. And it made it more difficult for us to identify and manage risk in the portfolio. All of these things obviously have implications for our ability to manage for long-term returns. And then what they also identified was the lack of certainty around funding, both for personnel and for risk management and for compliance. We have a unique structure in that the legislature really controls our personnel. And what we don't get through the legislative body, we outsource if we have to. And that's an expensive proposition, and I'll explain that in a minute. But you have your own fiduciary responsibilities. You have to balance a budget every 2 years, and you have to take into account current economic issues and current political issues. However, there's a disconnect between what we do. What we do is we enter into 10-year management contracts through our outsourcing model, and we manage for a 20-year horizon because we're managing a pension system for the long term that we assume will exist into perpetuity. So those were the things that were called out as a result of our asking, do we really have the right governance structure, and do we have access to the tools and the resources we need on a reliable, consistent basis to be able to identify and manage risk in the portfolio and take advantage of good investment opportunities? And the answer came back somewhat shockingly, heck no. And so that is the genesis of POP 101, as well as another bill that some of you know we've introduced called the Investment Modernization Act, Senate Bill, 134.
Thank you. That's helpful.
So moving away from this slide.
Senator Whitson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair. You've actually addressed a lot of what I wanted to ask. You do outsource a lot of your work. You do as well or outperform other states in your investment returns. So make us a business case. You've said that this is what your consultants have told you. Make us a business case why you believe that having more employees working for the Treasury would cause you to be more effective in improve your investment returns and risk management and so forth.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, I really want John Shervam to chime in on this, but I will give you my answer since you asked me directly, and then I'll let him give his answer, which is probably going to be technically more precise. When we have a model that makes it hard for us to staff back office operations, fund accountants, auditors, compliance officers, basic analytical support, and we have to outsource that, we're paying a premium to outsource those services. Those are positions we could easily fill here in the state of Oregon. We could save a lot of money doing it. I will give you a concrete example. I had the opportunity to visit one of our peer firms in New York City, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, and I got to visit one of our analysts' offices. The office was about half as big as the space that you're all sitting in, and it had a floor-to-ceiling glass window with a third-floor view looking down the entirety of Times Square. Who's paying for that office? We are. And so the business case here is that there are some things that are not high-level, high-added-value investment managers that we will continue to outsource because they continue to derive excellent returns. But there are some of those back-office operations and domestic equities and fixed-income tools that we could easily manage in-house that our peers are managing in-house, and they're going to get the same results we're going to get in those categories, and they're going to get it for a lot less. And so the business case is that the low-hanging fruit of the types of things that we would insource under Senate Bill 134, and POP 101 includes some of those positions, we can save between $20 and $25 million a year initially. And when you look at that 20-year time horizon over which we manage the pension system, you know, $20 to $25 million amortized at 7.5% over 20 years saves you nearly $1 billion. So for me, that's the business case. The more important part of the business case as it relates to Senate Bill 134 is on the governance model. We wouldn't have to bother you with these requests. Since these are other funds requests, we'd already be addressing the issues that the consultants had raised, and it would allow us to manage the portfolio for higher rates of return, which means billions in terms of our ability to fund the pension system. So that's the business case from my perspective. I don't know if the chief investment officer has a different perspective.
You just identify yourself for the record.
Chair Steiner, Hayward, members of the committee, John Shervam, chief investment officer. I don't have a different perspective, which is good since Ted's my boss, but I do have maybe some additional perspective I could add, and that would be the proposition is, in my mind, twofold. The first is these are resources that we need because there are things that today we are not doing that we simply must do. And so there are acute risks within the investment division today because there are things we are not doing because we don't have the resources that we must do. And I'll give you a very specific, really punch in the nose example. We trade millions of dollars of bonds every day, and the fellows that trade those bonds in the morning also settle those transactions in the afternoon. That's an egregious violation of separation of a standard compliance protocol.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but let me ask this. And Mr. Charger, I guess I'm directing this question to you. You're a statewide elected official, constitutionally created. Have you had an opportunity to bring those very specific examples in writing to the legislature to say, here they are. Here are the areas where we are vulnerable?
Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, over the last three sessions, I have attempted to bring this issue to the attention of the legislature. And it is here a third time in the context of Senate Bill 134 that has yet to receive a hearing. Part of the problem from my perspective is when there is no hearing, the letters I send to leadership, I don't know whether you all receive them or not.
Well, here's what I would encourage. I would strongly encourage for you to ensure that Madam Co-Chair and I receive a copy of that, and then we'll make sure that it goes up the chain as far as it needs to. Now, what the leadership decides to do will be between you and them, but I would encourage you to get this small little budget committee a list of that to keep us updated. Moving forward.
Thank you, Chair Smith and members of the committee. I will tell you point blank,
I am waving
the red flag on these issues.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, before we leave this, I'm just wondering what other collateral issues may be part and parcel of all of this. It's not just whether Senate Bill 134 moves or doesn't move. What are the other ramifications to some of the red flags that you're waving in terms of how Wall Street views us, in terms of our bond rating, in terms of if we can get away from who's pilfering who's personnel and who has nicer offices, what downstream ramifications are there?
Through the co-chairs, Senator Johnson, thank you for the question. There are multiple ramifications. First and foremost, as you can see from the chart that Senator Whitsitt pointed out, the portfolio will continue to grow. And the portfolio is already complex, and one would assume it will get increasingly complex as we continue to enter into more of a global economic environment. We can't control the size of the portfolio. It's going to continue to grow, but we can control the complexity in the portfolio or the amount of risk. If we don't have the tools, the resources, the personnel, and the ability to act nimbly and flexibly to changing market circumstances, or to be able to identify and manage risk in the portfolio, or to be able to do the things we are required to do around compliance, we reduce the level of complexity. That's the gas pedal. We can put our foot on it or we can take it off, because we can't control size. So if we reduce the complexity in the portfolio, that has a couple of implications. Most importantly, since 73 cents on every dollar in the pension system comes from investment returns, whatever we're not making in investment returns has to come from schools and from city and county budgets and state budgets in the form of increased employer contribution rates in the pension system. So that's implication number one. Milliman, who is the actuary for the PERS board, not for the Treasury, but the PERS board, has estimated that a reduction of 1% in the long-term assumed rate of return in the pension system adds about $8.5 billion of liability to the pension fund. That's one reason why I'm raising a red flag. Now, you asked about the ratings. I don't know if Laura Lockwood McCall, who's the debt manager for the state, could not be here today. She got through her part of the budget package last week, so I think she was excused. She would tell you that the funding level in the pension system is one of many important issues that the bond rating agencies ask about. They need to know that you can manage the assets in your pension system effectively. So there's that implication. When it comes to Wall Street, our ability to continue to seek out and do business with the top tier partners is an important part of why our fund has historically been successful over the decades. We don't do business with anybody. We seek out and do effective due diligence to find the best opportunities, and we've historically been very good at it. But if our people who do that work are getting buried, or they don't have the tools and the resources they need to be able to do that effectively, we're going to miss opportunities on one hand and potentially miss risk that exists in our portfolio on the other. I don't know, John, if you have.
So Senator Whitsitt has a question, then I'm going to get us moving forward here, because I don't want to run out of time.
Going to ask Mr. Sherman to finish his. You started out saying that we need to resolve acute risk, and you mentioned one, which certainly, from a small business perspective, that would be akin to having the same person do your day sheet, and asking for very significant embezzlement problems or whatever that way. So go ahead, please.
Chair Senator Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, I think the question was the value proposition, and in my mind, there's two elements to it. The first is there are a number of things that we aren't doing that we simply must do, and better operating practices, compliance procedures. We have a laundry list of examples. I gave you one, what I consider probably the most egregious, but there are many, and we can itemize those and share them with you. But the second half of the value proposition is the things that we should do. Opportunities that we just aren't capitalizing. And the way I would encourage you to think about our portfolio, as big and complex as it is, 60% of it is, and these are round numbers, 60% of it is public market assets, stocks and bonds. A very large proportion of that is middle of the fairway, plain vanilla stocks and bonds. Those are assets that my staff is completely capable. In fact, a report from Wilshire last summer identified the true talent that we have in the staff, and they are completely capable of managing those assets internally. The OIC took the responsible step of contracting with BlackRock Solutions to get the what's called the Aladdin operating platform, because the report last summer was you've got the talent, you've got the capability, but you don't have the infrastructure. The OIC has since rectified that deficiency by getting us the infrastructure. It'll be up and running by the end of the year. So what we should do is capitalize on our opportunities to do what we can internally, because as the treasurer pointed out, the external management of that is very expensive. And so I see it as those two elements, is doing what we must do to protect the fund and doing what we should do to run it more efficiently.
Thank you. So slide 19 just gives you an idea of the positions that we're requesting: four in operations, six in compliance, four in information services, three in administrative services, and six that are described as general investment positions. It's my understanding that if additional details on these positions and the timing of hiring has been provided to the co-chairs.
It has.
And I think Mr. Borden potentially has also received that information, and we can get that to people if they'd like. I will skip quickly through.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just need to be reminded how many of these position requests are inexorably tied to Senate Bill 134. I'm trying to figure out the risk to have one without the other, or are they? Is there a linkage?
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, none of them. I would say these positions are all absolutely necessary in mm-hmm. any environment, and I think the one thing that John and Ted didn't put out, and I would point you back to the risk gap chart that was there, the steep slope. All what we're trying to do is just address current operational risk in the portfolio. And if you took those orange and green lines and adjusted them for what we're asking for right here, this in no way solves our problem. It helps ameliorate the problem. It moves those lines up, but it doesn't get us the gap. And in the meantime, that'll be our staffing, and we'll continue with that over the course of the next biennium and on. And that gap is going to continue to grow, unless something really bad happens, which is the asset shrink. But instead, we know the assets are going to continue to grow over time. At the rate that they're growing, our staffing levels will continue, and again, the gap will grow.
And I would share with the committee that Madam Co-Chair and I had an opportunity to sit down with the Treasurer's Office and go through each of these positions, and we were able to ask our questions, and we found that there was wisdom in this in this policy option package coming forward. Madam Co-Chair?
Mr. Co-Chair, as usual, you and I are on the same bandwidth. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Great. Slide 20, and this gets to some degree to Co-Chair Smith's question about lists of specific examples. The reports I'm going to quote here get to the top line conclusions, or maybe you could call them the bottom line conclusions, but all of these reports cite specific examples to come to the conclusions that they've come to. Cutter Associates in 2011 concluded that low staffing levels present many challenges. It inhibits growth in new asset areas and strategies. It limits the ability to perform due diligence, oversight, and monitor investment risks, and exposes the Oregon State Treasury to operational and reputational risks. Funston in 2012 concluded risk, both investment and operational, is increasing due to a very aggressive portfolio strategy combined with insufficient resources to continue to adequately provide due diligence and oversight. However, the risk of the cost of prevention can be a hard sell. I didn't need to pay a consultant to tell me that. Funston Advisory Services, again, Oregon State Treasury and the Oregon Investment Council appear to have done a good job to date given the constraints of the current model, but the lack of resources, lack of autonomy, and the lack of a clear alignment of authorities and accountability with fiduciary responsibilities brings the OIC and the OST to a governance crossroads. CEM benchmarking in 2013, and I think this gets to a question that Senator Whitsitt had asked earlier. Your OPER fund was 4% internally managed. This was well below the peer average of 45% internally managed. Private equity and real estate assets were 38% of your total fund assets. This was above your peer average of 23%. So we have less internal management, and we have more complex external investments. The chart on the bottom, the only thing I really need you to notice is the very last line. Our external manager fees at 76.8 basis points are substantially higher, nearly double what our peers have. So we have a very expensive model, is what that chart is trying to show you, as a result of the governance model that requires us to outsource so heavily compared to what our peers are doing.
If I might add.
Remind me what OPERF stands for.
Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund.
Oh, it's a joke.
So
okay,
it's the investment assets in the pension fund, which is about $72 billion of the $88 that we're currently managing.
I just
managing.
Never think of it that way.
Sorry.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Tracy, I know you weren't in charge of during 2008, but it didn't appear to me that the money managers were anticipating the meltdown that Alan Greenspan had been warning about since 1996, the irrational exuberance. Some of us talked with staff and the former treasurer, but we seem to have gone whistling on into the dark until this crash came. I think there's opportunity sometime to, again, this might come back into you having more staff for risk management, I don't know, but to be able to look out ahead and say, you know, this thing is precarious, and we're reaching that point again. We're getting a lot of feedback from both the private sector and the public sector saying that the stock market where it is right now is once again pretty irrational. So should we be continued, or should be, I'm not saying we should get out, should be ratchet down, should we change positions and be willing to take a little lesser return for a while until the inevitable happens again and then reinvest? I mean, is that something that that giving you more staff would help you to do?
I'll take a swing at that. It's an excellent question. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Smith and Senator Whitsitt, the answer is yes. And let me give you a concrete example of why I think the answer is yes. Not to say that we're going to catch every trend in the market, but some number of years ago, it was 2 or 3 years ago, not long after I'd arrived as a member of the Oregon Investment Council, somebody asked a question during the meeting what our current exposure to the euro was. And this was at a time, of course, when there was great volatility in the euro and what was happening generally in the European community and the European markets. And it turned out that the answer to that question wasn't as simple as I would have expected it to be, because we have all these external relationships. We know within each of our hundreds of relationships what our exposure to the euro is at any given moment, because those fund managers have their own risk management systems. But we didn't have an umbrella capacity to be able to readily tell what our exposure was to the euro or a whole host of other potentially significant risk variables in the market. And so that sort of fed the fuel, if you will, to the fire of my desire to have people take a good hard look at our governance model and our operations to be able to understand, are we able to adequately identify and manage risk in the portfolio? I don't know if you had something else or John had a different...
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilson, I think what I would add is you just made a great case for risk management, for investment risk management, and which we don't have. We're currently in the process of buying it. We ought to have it on staff. It ought to be part of our processes. We don't have it. It's actually not part of this ask, but we are in the process of contracting with BlackRock to access their risk management services to be able to bring that in, as we're trying to prioritize what it is we can buy and what it is we can bring in and where, you know, what's our requisite responsibility relative to that. That's one of the areas. So it's a...
And another one is, you know, the erosion of confidence in the U.S. dollar with an $18 trillion federal debt, which you have nothing to do with, but, I mean, it's there. I would anticipate that... if that happens and when it happens, it will happen very quickly. And I would hope that that you had a plan too.
Yes. Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, again, an excellent point. As markets become more international and as we invest in every corner of the globe And as information flows more freely with increased technology and as competition increases, currency issues and foreign exchange become increasingly important in our risk calculus. And again, that requires personnel, tools, and back office infrastructure to be able to do it right. So, yes, sir.
So I want to follow up on Senator Whitsitt's question, because I heard you acknowledge that it was a good question, but I'm not sure I got the answer I needed. Does it make sense for the Treasurer's Office to pull back on the level of complexity in its investing until the legislature catches up with what your need is?
No. Co-chairs? No. And that is exactly what these consultant reports are trying to say, and I'm using them instead of just saying it myself.
I appreciate that. I can see that.
Because I'm trying to be diplomatic. But the answer, of course, is that the governance model we have makes very little sense. We have an outlier governance model where it's the 90 members of the legislature who determine the staffing capabilities of the members of the OIC who are actually the fiduciaries for the pension system. And as a result,
and I guess I want to put pressure on the legislature, not on you, but if we're not getting you the tools you need, I gotta be careful.
You gotta be careful.
Mr. Chair, I think the answer to the question you asked is actually yes. So if the council doesn't feel that it has the resources or the ability to maintain the resources, you know, kind of a stable resourcing model over time, as fiduciaries, they have very little choice but to simplify the portfolio, to bring it in line with the resources we have and believe we will reasonably have, and that will, in fact, impact the returns of the portfolio.
Most definitely. I mean, it's going to reduce the rate of returns.
So I think that was the question I heard.
Yeah, modem. It was.
So I'm almost reluctant to ask this question until Senator Johnson comes back in, because it's kind of the follow-up, but I'm going to ask it, and if we need to go back to it, we can, or we can decide to hold off on answering it. I need to circle back to her question about the staffing versus the bill, the governance structure change, right? And I think this committee is hearing you loud and clear that you're understaffed and that the OIC is understaffed for all the things that you need to be doing to both protect our current asset structure and investment structure, make sure that we're doing the risk management, and protect our future of all of the state funds, including OPERF and everything else. The question is, are the staff that you're asking for in POP 101 going to meet 80% of the need? And or are they going to meet 100% of the staffing need, but the worry is that we're going to yank them away from you again in 2 years because we're the ones in control?
Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, I'll take a swing at this, and as usual, let the technical experts clean up for me. This is what we need today, and it is what we can realistically absorb in the near term. It is a long way from what it would take to bring us up to industry best practice in terms of our appropriate staffing levels. To give you an idea of how far behind we are in terms of staffing relative to industry best practice and what our peers are doing, we would need the 23 positions that we're requesting today, and then on average we'd need about 30 additional positions for each of the four next four biennia. So, but you know, the reason we're not asking for that is we can't absorb that many FTEs realistically.
Okay.
I don't know.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I think the Treasurer is exactly right. To get us to an industry standard level of staffing, of resourcing the program, it's about 30 positions. For us, if we just said that we were willing to accept the level of risk that we were, where we'll be after this ask, I'll be back here asking for 5 to 8 positions forever, as the portfolio is expected to continue to grow and as these new opportunities come. But I will tell you, this level of, you know, this level of risk mitigation is not sufficient for this portfolio. We have a world-class portfolio. We do not staff it like it's a world-class portfolio.
This slide may help answer your question further, Chair Steiner Hayward.
Okay.
Cortex, it gets to why the governance model, in addition to just people.
Okay, can I point out one thing
yeah, please,
quickly on
ahead,
this
Darren.
Slide before
yeah.
we turn from
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you bet.
I would point out to the committee that while that external manager fees, while that is a really big number, that same group right there, CM Benchmarking, would tell you that we have some of the lowest external management fees in the business because of the effective negotiation skills that John and his team have. So we pay a lot because we're in expensive markets and we outsource a whole bunch. But relative to what we pay, we're really effective at negotiating these contracts. So if somebody else was doing what we're doing like we're doing it, they'd be paying a heck of a lot more.
So,
sorry. Well, go ahead to the next slide.
Okay, Cortex in 2012, this is slide 22. Both the Oregon Investment Council and the Oregon State Treasury have limited authority with respect to the compensation of OST staff. In comparison, the other governing bodies, with the exception of New Jersey, have the authority to select their own staff and set compensation policies in practice. Cortex also mentions what are considered best practices. There are two model laws that investment operations around the country look at. The first is the Uniform Model Public Employee Retirement System Act. The next is the Uniform Public Investment Act. Consistent with published standards, including the two model laws, the OIC should have greater autonomy over the administration of the Oregon funds. Ideally, this would include autonomy and authority to select and direct staff, to set staff compensations, to they should have authority over resource allocation, including establishing the budget, and to retain advisory and other services such as legal counsel, the investment custodian, and the external financial auditor. Finally, on page 23, Cortex 2012, the OIC should recommend to the state legislature that the council be structured as an independent government agency with its own supporting staff in a manner similar to that of most peer group members and other public investment boards in the United States and Canada. Wilshire, who did an outside analysis, indicated that Wilshire's scores primarily reflect Wilshire's concerns about Oregon State Treasury's investment technology and resource deficiencies and the adverse impacts these deficiencies have on the respective fixed income and equity investment processes. Despite these deficiencies, OST investment teams have demonstrated success in their respective internal management activities. In summary, Wilshire's overall team scores would be higher with improvement to the team's technology and systems infrastructure, and thus the investment in the BlackRock risk management solution.
Wilshire told us our staff did a great job, but if they were assessing us for one of their clients, they wouldn't recommend to the client to give us their money because of the inadequate infrastructure we have supporting our investment activities.
So that's please follow up, and I'll go over to the center. That's it.
So, Senator Johnson, when you were out of the room, I sort of asked the question again that you had asked earlier, but refined it a little bit differently about, you know, where we would get with this amount of staff. And Mr. Treasurer said 23 now, 30 per biennium for the next four biennia. Did I hear
to get us to industry standard with
industry
the current size of the
with
portfolio,
the current size of the portfolio
allocation.
But the piece on the previous slide suggested that part of the problem relates to the inability to set your own compensation structure, to do all that kind of stuff, because you are a state agency. I guess I'm trying to figure out, I'm still trying to wrestle, and we've been talking about this for 3 months now, so this is not a new conversation for us, but it's a new conversation for the committee. I'm still wrestling with how to, What's our priority here? Is the policy the priority? Are the people the priority? Are they both the priority? Are they equal? Where do we, how do we walk the very delicate path with not going so far toward independence for the investment council that we start to have a bunch of really nervous legislators, because right now we haven't done so well with independent public corporation type entities, which is essentially what 134 proposes. On the other hand, we don't run screaming in the opposite direction too far and not give you the staff that you need in the way that you promised. And is there a way to alleviate some of the discomfort? I'm asking you four questions at once, which really isn't fair. Is there a way to alleviate some of the discomfort among the outside evaluators and within your team by, while on the one hand we can't give you a guarantee, on the other hand, essentially you guys are other funds. It's not like we're pushing in the general fund to fund all these positions for you. We're just basically saying, okay, we're going to take the money off the top of our investment returns, right?
Correct.
So if we put on record, okay, you're telling us you need 23 now, 30 next quinquennium, 30 in 1921, et cetera, et cetera. And we're committing, as long as any of us are here and to keep talking to our successors, that we get that, and you just need to keep updating us on where you are, and we'll keep funding you as fast as you can absorb them. And how far would that get us toward addressing these concerns without the governance structure changes requested in Senate Bill 134?
Excellent, and those questions are all related, Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee. So let me do my best to answer this as best as I can. First of all, I want to say that we're appreciative of what appears to be support for the POP. I don't want anybody to think that we in the Treasury don't think that's valuable and important. And if you give us this POP, I want you to know we are grateful for it, and it will definitely help us move in the right direction. That said, we cannot begin the process of insourcing the kind of operations that we're discussing in Senate Bill 134 without certainty that we will have the ability to be resourced and personneled and have the systems and the flexibility for the long term. Because again, we enter into multi-year contracts, 10-year contracts that will, and we manage for 20 years. And there is no way, even though I trust, I know every person on this panel, and I trust all of you implicitly, there's no way that you can guarantee that to us.
Absolutely, you're not
here for 2 years at a time, and we've, in 2003, we were told to come up with a 10% reduction in personnel, which we did, and I think there was an instance prior to that. I don't remember the exact year, but sometime in the 1990s. And I want to remind you that by implementing the new governance model, it costs taxpayers nothing, and it saves money, and it allows us to manage the portfolio better for the long term. So it's a win, win, win. Now, in terms of how to make you feel better, we negotiated at great length, in particular with Senator Devlin during the last legislative session, because he had raised this on behalf of the legislative body that there were concerns and that there still needed to be some degree of oversight. So we came to a number of what I think are important compromises that are reflected in the Senate bill. In addition, Cliff Bentz in the House has suggested an additional organization that would be something like the Debt Policy Advisory Commission that would include legislators who participate in and watch and understand how investment decisions are being made and what the relationship is with our external partners. And we think that's great. So if there's a way to get to yes on Senate Bill 134 that makes you feel comfortable that you have enough legislative oversight and have the ability to pull back our budget if you feel that there's something we're doing that is egregiously incorrect, we believe that's worked into the Senate bill. We believe we've gotten there.
I do have a question for staff.
John, what's the roll-up cost on that 23 positions? It's $7.4 million this biennium.
Please.
Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I'm sorry I don't have those handy. There are some number of technical adjustments to these positions, but
I guess, is there a significant difference?
These positions, if I may, phase in right around September of this year. So it's the normal, you know, hiring process. So there are about 22 months of costs that are reflected here.
So I would point out to the co-chairs, and I'll shut up, that's about 0.08% of the portfolio that they manage.
If I might add to that very insightful comment, I think it's really important to try to keep perspective on what this is, on the ask that this is all about. The council are fiduciaries for $90 billion of assets. Currently, just for the OPERF piece, we're probably next biennium going to spend $1 billion on those outsource relationships. That's how much we spend to get this managed. The council right now controls 98.3%, I believe, or 98.4%, I guess, currently, of the spend relative to this portfolio, totally outside of legislative oversight. They enter into these contracts with these managers and consultants under their fiduciary authority as delegated by law. We're talking about giving them control over that last 1.6% of the spend so that they can turn that into the same kinds of positive decisions that have made this state billions of dollars and will save this state over time billions of dollars. That's what this discussion boils down to.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Smith. I just have a question. Maybe it's in here and I can't seem to find it. And I apologize if it was presented at a different meeting. But so what's the delta of the difference between the fees that we're paying to outsource versus having our own employees do this? What is the, because it seems to me there would be a savings to have us do it internally for some of those services.
Sure. Let's look at public
equity. Approximately.
How about if we look at public equity? So we believe that our public equity investment costs are about half a basis point.
Okay.
We pay some managers 50 basis points. We have in the past paid managers as much as 82 basis points, but that manager is no longer currently in the portfolio. So this is that's the kind of delta we're talking about. So when we tell you that we can add, you know, we can create the Oregon Investment Department, we can add all of this staff, and we can still save the state tens of millions of dollars, they're rock hard numbers.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair. So that's a very serious example. On a whole, though, I mean, is that time after time, regardless of the fund or the activity, or is that always
time after time? Active management is very expensive.
Yeah, I actually am aware of the fact of how expensive these, for various reasons, understand that you're paying a lot to have these done. I think oftentimes in government we think, oh, outsource, it's cheaper. But I think this is an example of where the outsourcing is not necessarily the most efficient way to do it. And some of these things, and maybe what we folks need to be convinced of, is that we have the capability of doing it. There are people that we could hire. So can you talk to us a little bit about the fact that we would be able to find qualified people to come and work for whatever salary you're planning on paying them here? Because that's the only area that I support all of this, just to be very clear. But I think that this makes a lot of sense. I will say from my experience of working as a management auditor is that we have a really hard time finding auditors, because working in the public sector, and I think Treasurer Wheeler, many have forgotten, was the chair of Multnomah County, and I had a lot of interactions with the audits division there too, that it's hard to find people who are willing to do the hard work that is involved for the salary that is being paid. So I just need to know that you have some sort of research has been done, you know, being a desk audit or something by human resources or whatever, to figure out that there are people who are willing to come work for the state, you know, for maybe less money.
They could make it. Representative Taylor, if I could just, before I answer, ask one clarifying question. Are you talking about relative just to this ask, or are you relative, or 134 in kind of the big picture?
Well, just either. Just that there's going to be people, because this is obviously we cannot afford, it's not a good idea, in my opinion, to go out and hire people to do these services when they're so extremely expensive. And if we can do them internally for a cheaper price, then.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Taylor. I assume we're doing this because it's going to save us money.
The short answer is yes.
Yes.
I hire them now. So we do everything we're talking about. We just do it on a very limited basis.
Right.
We currently have public equity staff running money for us.
Okay, so hiring people is not going to be a problem.
We can get more people. Mm-hmm. Fixed income, we can get more people.
Okay.
The tools are out there. We can buy the tools. the key is, and for all of, and to give you some reassurance, when you look at the positions and the way we went, we looked at the industry, we tried to set adequate compensation.
Okay,
we actually went out and talked to recruiters about whether or not for the positions we thought we needed to do national recruitment on, whether the salaries we expected to pay were ballpark salaries to get someone to Oregon. So we believe that the numbers in the relative to the positions are very solid asks. But again, in the big picture, relative to solving that big problem, that you're not talking about just adding staff and getting to Oregon. You're talking about making significant strategic directional changes to this portfolio that are changes that are going to live for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to get the council to the place where they have the enough assurance to do that, they're going to have, I believe, significantly more control over these resource decisions.
Okay, so here's where we are. We have 22 minutes left. We're on slide 22, and we have about five more slides to go, somewhere right in there. So I want to make sure you have ample time to share your message.
Mr. Chair, and if I believe we talked about everything except for this POP last time. So I think some of the other slides were relative to the 529 plan.
Right, so I think 24 is all.
So unless you want to talk about reduction option packages, I think other than just the details on 24 is probably all we had that we expected to talk about today.
Okay. Colleagues, any other questions for our state treasurer, staff?
Senator Whitson.
Assuming that this policy option package is approved, and I assume that it will be, and you have 23 positions that you can fill in September, will you be able to fill those positions, have them up and running, and be able to be back in February with an additional request?
No. I don't believe so. I don't believe that. I mean, just to be honest, it'd be nice. I'd like to think so, but and while I like to think I'm pretty talented, I'm not that talented. So we have a schedule of what we believe is a reasonable time to hire staff. I think one of the key things is we're talking about some really critical, very talented staff. Recruitments will be long, you know, the 3 to 4 month kind of time frame that it takes for a typical national recruitment. While we think we have a really good idea of what this ought to look like, we really need to get those key positions onboarded. They need to get a feel for what we have, for the tools that we have, and they need to help us, they need to help us see then what the organization really needs to look like on a go-forward basis. They need to have participation in designing that next layer of hiring, and I wouldn't presume to try to do that for them.
I might encourage, because when we met with you, you had a calendar that kind of spelled out that timeline on the hires. I might encourage to make sure all the committee folks get a chance to take a look at that, because there was a lot of logic in what you were sharing.
Mr. Chair, I think John has it.
And
it's posted.
And it's posted. So it's right there to share that. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Assuming that these people move ahead out of this sub, do you have the physical plant space to accommodate them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the part of the POP is rent money for us to be able to expand our South Tigard office. So, in terms of we're going to go find bigger space for this staff, and our expectation is that we will consolidate all of our. Now we have two shops for the investment program, a very small one in Tigard, and we'll consolidate. Our expectation is to consolidate the bulk of the investment program all in Wilsonville, Tigard, somewhere in that area up there.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry, I must have just missed that. Sorry.
Okay. One last question. On the recruitment process, are you anticipating the vast majority of these folks will come from out of state?
No.
You think they'll be Oregonians?
I expect probably two people will. That's my current expectation,
sure.
Is that probably two people will come from out of state.
Got it. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Treasurer, Mr. Bond.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I wasn't three. I forgot about the senior alternatives who may very well come from out of state. That'll be a probably a larger recruitment. Sorry, Senator.
It's quite all right, Mr. Bond.
I know.
Mr. Treasurer, Mr. Bond, Mr. Hara, Mr. Everybody who's here and who has been here over the past multiple times that you've been in front of us this year, I want to thank you because, first of all, we've had to reschedule you 12,000 times. This has been one of the most discombobulated schedules that this committee, I think, has ever experienced due to the joys of five-hour floor sessions. And you've been thorough and patient with all of our questions, both in the committee hearings and outside. My co-chair and I have met with you separately or together on more occasions than I care to admit, and probably you care to remember. This is a very challenging problem, and we acknowledge that. We hear you loud and clear about the need for this person and these new personnel, and we understand that very clearly, and I think we're in reasonably good shape in that regard. I also personally, and I think many of us in this committee, understand the issues around the governance structure. I have no clue what's going to happen at this point about that, although I will say that I think that I will personally be talking with more people about your presentation today because it's given me even more insight than I had already, and I was supportive of these changes in 13 and in 14. That being said, I respect our presiding officers and their choices. I'm not trying to go throwing them under the bus. I hope that we can continue to communicate very closely both this session and during the interim about progress toward risk management, towards onboarding new people, toward next steps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I personally will commit to working as closely with you as you will let me to help you achieve the goals that you need to achieve to make sure that our investments are protected and allowed to continue to grow in ways that will benefit the state. So I just want to put that on the record as a statement and as a thank you to all of you for your hard work. I cannot guarantee anything about the policy side.
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. Thank you very much for your thoroughness and your patience. We appreciate it, and we understand that the schedule is difficult and has not been a problem. We appreciate and respect the fact that you gave us as much time as you did. So thank you.
Really quick before we scoot, John and I were just visiting. Can you just share with us just really quick that top bullet point? Can you just walk through
I'll
that with us
that,
just
yeah.
very, very quickly?
Right.
We just want to make sure we really understand
that. And the numbers are a little weird. And the governor's recommended we'd ask for 19. Actually, one of the 19 that we'd asked for was moved forward into the e-board request, mm-hmm. along with the five operational positions. It was an investment position, a front office investment position. As it ended up, that was the only position we got. So the five now are back in here. Makes it look like there's really only, you know, the numbers look a little off, but it's because one was moved forward. So 19 plus 5 is, in this math, actually 23, the way government budgeting works. It's great.
Perfect. Thank you. All righty, colleagues. I think we're going to wrap up for the day. And Mr. Treasurer, I want to echo what my co-chair shared.
Thank you.
We really appreciate the work you're doing. And in several situations, you have deserve much more respect than we were able to give you simply because of the way floor session both on the Senate and the House side got handled. So please forgive
I appreciate
us
it. Yeah, thank you.
We really appreciate what you're doing. We're blessed to have you as our state treasurer. I have to share with you, committee, I'm feeling like after this conversation that I should no longer have my money invested in Big Lou's Taco House and Home of Investments. I may have to rethink this a little bit. This is complex stuff. And we appreciate you. And we're going to take everything you've shared with us under consideration. I can share with you that my co-chair and I, with our LFO staff, will be further visiting on this issue. We'll be visiting with our co-chairs and letting them know how this conversation's played out and the wisdom that you've shared with us.
Thank you.
So we really appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Colleagues, see no other business before us. John, anything we need to think about?
No, co-chairs. You don't have a meeting tomorrow, of course, because it's Friday, and Monday is a holiday, so no meeting on Monday. And Tuesday you will have an informational hearing on state and local credit card contracting.
Julie, are we good? All righty. Colleagues, we're going to adjourn for the weekend. That has a nice ring to it. The weekend.